the U.S. government, more or less reluctantly, concluded that Russian participation was essential, though some of the Russian data were redundant because observatories in Japan, China, and India were recording those signals as well. Indeed, every substantial radio telescope in the world that had Vega in its sky was listening. The moment the Americans and the Russians decided to collaborate, and the Memorandum of Agreement was solemnly signed, every other nation with a radio telescope had agreed to cooperate. Every nation tried to make some sense out of the pulses, but so far, no one could tell even if the message was written in symbols or in pictures. It was perfectly conceivable that they would not decrypt the message until it cycled back to page one. If it ever did, and began again with the introduction, the primer, the decoding key, maybe it wouldn't cycle back for 100 years. Or maybe there was no primer. Maybe the message was an intelligence test, so those worlds too stupid to decrypt it would be unable to misuse its contents. There was a kind of world message consortium, and people were actually talking in those terms. They needed one another's data and brain power if the message was to be decrypted. Religious sects, established, marginal, and some newly invented for the purpose, were dissecting the theological implications of the message. Some thought it was from God, and some from the devil. There was a nasty resurgence of interest in Hitler and the Nazi regime. There were those who considered listening to the signal an abomination, and who urged the observatories to stop. Others considered it a token of advent, and urged the construction of still larger radio telescopes, some of them in space. Some cautioned against working with the Russian data on the ground that they might be falsified or fraudulent. And there were those who sensed a change in the world political climate, and contended that the very existence of the message, even if it was never decrypted, was exercising a steadying influence on the quarrelsome nation-states. Those who favored such cheerful prognoses sometimes found themselves edging uncomfortably toward ground that had been occupied for a decade by the Kileastic movement. Some Kileasts held that the imminent arrival of the third millennium would be accompanied by the return of Jesus, or Buddha, or Krishna, or the prophet, who would establish on earth a benevolent theocracy, severe in its judgment of mortals. Perhaps this would presage the mass celestial ascent of the elect. But there were other Kileasts, and there were far more of these who held that the physical destruction of the world was the indispensable prerequisite for the advent, as had been unerringly foretold in various otherwise mutually contradictory ancient prophetic works. Attendance in churches had soared all over America. The message was a kind of mirror in which each person saw his or her own beliefs challenged or confirmed. It was taken as evidence for many gods, or one god, or none. One of the emerging leaders of public opinion was the Reverend Palmer Joss. When Ellie saw one of his rare television appearances, he was immediately recognizable for his resonant voice, his slightly unkempt good looks, and the discoloration beneath his eyes that made you think he never slept for worrying about the rest of us. He was deeply disturbed about science and scientists. "The scientists keep their findings to themselves and give us little bits and pieces, enough to keep us quiet. They think we're too stupid to understand what they do. And when we ask for explanations, they tell us it takes years to understand. Now, I know about that, because in religion, also, there are things that take years to understand. You can spend a lifetime and never come close to understanding the nature of Almighty God. And now they say they have a message from the star Vega. But a star can't send a message. Who is sending it? Is its purpose divine or satanic? I tell you, my friends, science is too important to be left to the scientists. Representatives of the major faiths ought to be part of the process of decoding. Remember, the scientists don't always get it right. They want to take away our faith, our beliefs, and they offer us nothing of spiritual value in return. Now, I do not intend to abandon God because the scientists write a book and say it is a message from Vega." Dahir had asked Ellie if they could have a quiet dinner somewhere. He was flying in for the summary session with the Russian delegation on the latest progress in the interpretation of the message. But South Central New Mexico was crawling with the world's press, and there was no restaurant for 100 miles in which they could talk unobserved and unheard. so Ellie made dinner herself in her modest apartment at the Argus facility. There was a great deal to talk about. Sometimes it seemed that the fate of the whole project was hanging by a presidential thread. But the little tremor of anticipation she felt just before Ken's arrival was occasioned, she was vaguely aware, by more than that. When they had finished dinner and got down to business, it turned out to be Palmer Joss whom Dahir wanted to discuss. Ellie said, "Ken, the man is scared stiff. He imagines the message is going to be something that shakes his faith. He has no idea about how a new scientific paradigm subsumes the previous one. He wants to know what science has done for him lately, and he's supposed to be the voice of reason." Dahir shook his head. "Compared with the Doomsday Kilias and the Earth Firsters, Palmer Joss is the soul of moderation. Maybe we haven't explained the methods of science as well as we should have. Ellie, we're in a bind. You know Joss is very influential. He's been close to 3 presidents, including President Lasker. She is inclined to make some concession to him, although I don't think she wants to put him and a bunch of other preachers on the preliminary decryption committee. The whole thing could unravel over this, so why don't we go and talk to him? The president says that Joss is really fascinated by science. Well, suppose we won him over." Ellie smiled. "We're going to convert Palmer Joss?" "Of course not. I'm not imagining making him change his religion. Let's just make him understand what Argus is about, how we don't have to answer the message if we don't like what it says, how interstellar distances quarantine us from Vega. Ken, he doesn't even believe that the velocity of light is a cosmic speed limit. We're going to be talking past each other. I'm not sure a meeting between Joss and me is what you want, or the president." "Ellie, I know who I'd put my money on. I don't see how getting together with Joss could make things much worse." She allowed herself to return his smile. Ellie had planned to meet her friend Vasily Grigorovich Lunacharsky's plane in Albuquerque and drive him back to the Argus facility in her Thunderbird. But the new security people from the General Services Administration had vetoed the idea. Media attention had brought enormous crowds to the isolated desert site. There was a potential for violence, they had told Ellie. She must in future travel only in government cars, and then only with discreetly armed escorts. It would be good to spend some time with Vega again. Everybody called him that after the initials of his first name and patronymic. She had last seen him in Moscow 3 years before. He was a Nobel laureate in physics and a full member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. With the tracking ships now in place and a few small but adequate radio telescopes installed in such places as Reykjavik and Jakarta, there was now redundant coverage of the signal from Vega at every longitudinal swath. A major conference of the full World Message Consortium was scheduled to be held in Paris. In preparation, it was natural for the nations with the largest fraction of the data to hold a preparatory scientific discussion. They had been meeting for the better part of 4 days, and this summary session was intended mainly to bring up to speed those such as Dahir, who served as intermediaries between the scientists and the politicians. Vega clearly felt himself under unusual pressures. He had resumed chain smoking. He held the cigarette between his thumb and forefinger, palm up, as he talked. "I agree that there is adequate overlap in longitude, but I'm still worried about redundancy. A failure in the helium liquefier on board our tracking ship Marshal Nedelin, or a power failure in Reykjavik, and the continuity of the message is in jeopardy. I suppose the message takes 2 years to cycle around to the beginning. If we miss a piece, we will have to wait 2 more years to fill in the gap. And remember, we don't know that the message will be repeated. I think we need to plan even for unlikely possibilities." Dahir asked, "Something like emergency generators for every observatory in the consortium?" "Yes, and independent amplifiers, spectrometers, autocorrelators, disk drives and so forth, and some provision for fast airlift of liquid helium to remote observatories if necessary." "Ellie, do you agree?"
Absolutely.
"Anything else, Vega?"
"I think we should continue to observe Vega on a very broad range of frequencies. Perhaps tomorrow a different message will come through on only one of the message frequencies. We should also monitor other regions of the sky. Maybe the key to the message won't come from Vega, but from somewhere else.
Peter Valerian broke in.
Let me say why I think Vega's point is important. This is a unique moment, when we're receiving a message, but have made no progress at all in decrypting it. We have no previous experience along these lines. We have to cover all the bases. We don't want to wind up a year or two from now kicking ourselves because there was some simple precaution we forgot to take or some simple measurement that we overlooked.
The idea that the message will cycle back is the merest guess. There's nothing in the message itself to suggest it. Any opportunities lost now may be lost for all time. I also agree there's more instrumental development that needs doing. For all we know, there's a fourth layer to the palimpsest.
Vega nodded vigorously. There is also the question of personnel. I suppose this message goes on not for a year or two, but for decades. Or suppose this is just the first in a long series of messages from all over the sky. There are at most a few hundred really capable radio astronomers in the world. That is a very small number when the stakes are so high. The industrialized countries must start producing many more radio astronomers and radio engineers with first-rate training.
Lighting a fresh cigarette from the glowing tip of its predecessor, Vega went on.
There is something else to be said. This is just speculation. It's not even as plausible as the idea that the message will cycle back on itself, which Professor Valerian quite properly stressed was only a guess. I would not ordinarily mention so speculative an idea at such an early stage. But if the speculation is sound, there are certain further actions we must begin thinking about immediately. I would not have the courage to raise this possibility if my colleague Gingrich Arkhangelsky had not come tentatively to the same conclusion. He and I have had many disagreements. I must admit that sometimes he has been right, and sometimes I have been right. Almost never, it seems to me, in the early speculative stages of the subject, have we agreed. But on this, we agree. Gingrich Dimitch, would you explain? Arkhangelsky seemed tolerant, even amused. We guess that the message is the instructions for building a machine. Of course, we have no knowledge about how to decode the message. The evidence is in internal references. I give you an example. Here on page 15,441 is a clear reference to an earlier page, 13,097, which by luck we also have. On page 13,097, there is another reference. This to a time when we were not covering all longitudes. There are many cases of the back referencing. In general, and this is the important point, there seem to be complicated instructions on a recent page, but simpler instructions on an earlier page. In one case, there are 8 citations to earlier material on a single page.
Ellie looked doubtful.
That's not an awfully compelling argument, guys. You know, maybe it's a set of mathematical exercises, the later ones building on the earlier ones. Maybe it's a long novel in which events are connected with childhood experiences or whatever they have on Vega when they're young. Maybe it's a tightly cross-referenced religious manual.
Derheer laughed. The 10 billion commandments.
Vega stared out the window at the telescopes through a cloud of cigarette smoke. But when you look at the patterns for cross-references, I think you'll agree that it looks more like the instruction manual for building a machine. God knows what the machine is supposed to do. Ellie was waiting for arrangements to be made for her meeting with Palmer Joss, and also for the day, still some weeks off, when she would fly to Paris for the first full meeting of the World Message Consortium. She and Vega were coordinating the Global Data Collection Program. The signal acquisition was now fairly routine, and in recent months, there had been not one gap in the coverage. So she found, to her surprise, that she had a little time on her hands. She vowed to visit her mother, who was in a nursing home in Wisconsin, sadly depleted in physical and mental health. There was an absurd amount of backed-up paper and electronic mail to go through, not just congratulations and criticisms from colleagues, but religious admonitions, pseudoscientific speculations, and fan mail from all over the world. She had not read the astrophysical journal in months,
although she was the first author of a very recent paper that was surely the most extraordinary article that had ever appeared in that august publication. The signal from Vega was so strong that many amateurs, tired of ham radio, had begun constructing their own small radio telescopes and signal analyzers. In the early stages of message acquisition, they had turned up some useful data, and Ellie was still besieged by amateurs who thought they had acquired something unknown to the SETI professionals. She felt an obligation to write encouraging letters. There were other meritorious radio astronomy programs at the facility, the quasar survey, for example, that needed attending to. But instead of doing all these things, she found herself spending almost all her time with Ken. Of course, it was her duty to involve the president's science advisor in Project Argus as deeply as he wished. It was important that the president be fully and competently informed. President Lasker, while untrained in science, genuinely liked the subject and was willing to support science not only for its practical benefits, but at least a little for the joy of knowing. This had been true of few American leaders since James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Still, it was remarkable how much time Derheer was able to spend at Argus. He did devote an hour or more each day in high bandpass scrambled communication with his office in Washington, but the rest of the time, as far as she could see, he was simply around. She would find him talking casually with Drumlin or Valerian, but equally so with junior technicians and with the secretarial staff. Derheer had many questions for her as well. At first, they were purely technical and programmatic, but soon they extended to plans for a wide variety of conceivable future events, and then to untrammeled speculation. These days, it almost seemed that these discussions were only a pretext to spend a little time together. They had been slow in recognizing that they were falling in love. It must have been apparent to many others. A few weeks before, when Vega was still at Argus, he was commenting to Ellie on the irrationality of American English. For instance, head over heels in love. This is a common expression, yes, but it's exactly backwards, or rather upside down. You are ordinarily head over heels. When you are in love, you should be heels over head, am I right? You would know about falling in love. But whoever invented this phrase did not know about love. He imagined you walk around in the usual way instead of floating upside down in the air like the work of that French painter. What's his name? He was Russian, Marc Chagall. Afterwards, she wondered if Vega had been teasing her or probing for a response. At least one reason for Derheer's reluctance was clear. For the president's science advisor to become emotionally involved with one of the message principles was risky. He should be able to recommend courses of action that Ellie opposed, and to urge rejection of options that she supported. Falling in love with Ellie would on some level compromise Derheer's effectiveness. For Ellie, it was more complicated. Before she had acquired the somewhat staid respectability of the directorship of a major radio observatory, she had had many partners. While she had felt herself in love and declared herself so, marriage had never seriously tempted her. She recalled how charming John Stoughton had been to her while courting her mother, and how easily he had cast off this pose after he became her stepfather. Some new and monstrous persona could emerge in men shortly after you married them. Her romantic predispositions made her vulnerable, she thought. She was not going to repeat her mother's mistake. A little deeper was a fear of falling in love without reservation, of committing herself to someone who might then be snatched from her, or simply leave her. But if you never really fall in love, you can never really miss it. She was dimly aware that this sentiment did not ring quite true. Also, if she never really fell in love with someone, she could never really betray him, as in her heart of hearts she felt that her mother had betrayed her long-dead father. She still missed him terribly. With Ken, it seemed to be different. Unlike many other men she could think of when challenged or stressed, Ken displayed a gentler, more compassionate side. His tendency to compromise and his skill in scientific politics were part of his job, but underneath, she felt she had glimpsed something solid. She respected him for the way he had integrated science into the whole of his life and for the courageous support for science that he had tried to inculcate in two administrations. They had, as discreetly as possible, been staying together more or less in her small apartment at Argus. Their conversations were a joyous exchange of ideas. Sometimes they responded to each other's uncompleted thoughts with almost perfect foreknowledge. He was a considerate and inventive lover. And anyway, She liked his pheromones. She was sometimes amazed at what she was able to do and say in his presence because of their love. She came to admire him so much that his love for her affected her own self-esteem. She liked herself better because of him, and he clearly felt the same. In the presence of so many of her friends, she had felt an undercurrent of loneliness. With Ken, it was gone. It was odd the way it had worked out. She'd imagined that Palmer Joss would come to the Argus facility, watch the signal being gathered in by the radio telescopes, and take note of the huge room full of magnetic tapes and discs on which the previous many months of data were stored. He would ask a few scientific questions and then examine some of the reams of computer printout displaying the still incomprehensible message. She hadn't imagined spending hours arguing philosophy or theology. But Joss had refused to come to Argus. It wasn't magnetic tape he wanted to scrutinize, he said. It was human character. Peter Valerian would have been ideal for this discussion, unpretentious, able to communicate clearly, and bulwarked by a genuine Christian faith that engaged him daily. But the president had apparently vetoed the idea. She had wanted a small meeting and had explicitly asked that Ellie attend. Ken Derheer would be with her, but it was Ellie that Palmer Joss wanted to meet. Joss had insisted that the discussion be held here, at his religious center in Modesto, California. Joss, the faintest of smiles on his face, his eyes half closed and his head bowed in what seemed an attitude of prayer, was listening carefully to what Ellie had to say. "Reverend Joss, I want you to understand that I'm not attacking anybody's belief system. As far as I'm concerned, you're entitled to any doctrine you like, even if it's demonstrably wrong. I saw your talk on television a few weeks ago. You and I are Christians, but you don't speak for me. Let me try to explain why I think some of the things you're saying are improbable. You're uncomfortable with scientific skepticism, but the reason it developed is that the world is complicated. It's subtle. Everybody's first idea isn't necessarily right. Also, people are capable of self-deception. Now, scientists make mistakes, theologians make mistakes, everybody makes mistakes. It's part of being human. So the way that you avoid making mistakes, or at least reduce the chance that you'll make one, is to be skeptical. You test the ideas. You check them out by rigorous standards of evidence. And I don't think there's such a thing as a received truth. But when you let the different opinions debate, when any skeptic can perform his or her own experiment to check some contention out, then the truth tends to emerge. That's the experience of the whole history of science. It isn't a perfect approach, but it's the only one that seems to work. Now, when I look at religion, I see lots of contending opinions. For example, the Christians think the universe is a finite number of years old. The Hindus, on the other hand, think that the universe is infinitely old, with an infinite number of subsidiary creations and destructions along the way. They can't both be right. You ought to debate Hindus. God seems to have told them something different from what he told you, but you tend to talk only to yourselves. The major religions on the earth contradict each other, left and right. You can't all be correct. And what if all of you are wrong? It's a possibility, you know. You must care about the truth, right? Well, the way to winnow through all the different contentions is to be skeptical. I'm not any more skeptical about your religious beliefs than I am about every new scientific idea I hear about. But in my line of work, they're called hypotheses, not inspiration and not revelation. The civilization on Vega, with powers infinitely less than those you attribute to your God, was able to make things very clear. If your God wanted to talk to us through the unlikely means of word-of-mouth transmission and ancient writings over thousands of years, he could have done it so there was no room left for debate about his existence. It's easy. Just a few enigmatic phrases and some fierce commandment that they be passed on unchanged. Joss leaned forward. Such as? Such as, the sun is a star, or Mars is a rusty place with deserts and volcanoes like Sinai, or, let's see now, thou shalt not travel faster than light, you know, anything that couldn't possibly have been known 3,000 years ago. Any others? Well, let's see. The way of the earth is as two, but the way of the lodestone is as three. I'm trying to suggest that the gravitational force follows an inverse square law, while the magnetic dipole force follows an inverse cube law. Or in biology. She nodded toward Dirhir, who seemed to have taken a vow of silence. How about two strands entwined is the secret of life? Joss nodded. Now, that's an interesting one. You're talking, of course, about DNA. But you know the physician's staff, the symbol of medicine? It's called the caduceus. It shows two serpents intertwined. It's a perfect double helix. Now, from ancient times, that's been the symbol of preserving life. Isn't this exactly the kind of connection you're suggesting? Well, I thought it's a spiral, not a helix, but if there are enough symbols and enough prophecies, I mean, eventually a few of them are going to fit some current scientific understanding purely by accident. Maybe you're right. Maybe the caduceus is a message from God. Of course, it's not a Christian symbol or a symbol of any of the major religions today, and I don't suppose you'd want to argue that the gods talked only to the ancient Greeks, but what I'm saying is, if God wanted to send us a message, he could have done a better job. Like, where are the burning bushes, the pillars of fire, the great voice booming down at us out of the sky? But a voice from the sky is just what you say you found. You think maybe the message is the voice of God, your God? Where in your religion does God answer a prayer by repeating the prayer back? I wouldn't call a Nazi newsreel a prayer myself. And you say it's to attract our attention? Well, then why do you think God has chosen to send this message to scientists? Why not to preachers? The words sounded rancorous, and Dirhir was clearly alarmed. Maybe I could remind us all about what we hope to accomplish at this meeting? Here's Ken in his mollifying mode, Ellie thought. On some issues, he's courageous, but chiefly when he has no responsibility for action. He's a brave talker, in private. But on scientific politics, and especially when representing the president, he becomes very accommodating. She interrupted her thoughts. That's another thing. If that signal is from God, why does it come from just one place in the sky, in the vicinity of a particularly bright nearby star? Why doesn't it come from all over the sky at once, like the cosmic blackbody background radiation? Coming from one star, it looks like a signal from another civilization. Coming from everywhere, it would look much more like a signal from your God. Ken looked directly at Ellie. Please, if we don't keep more to the agenda, I don't see how we can accomplish what the president asked us to do. Well, you wanted a frank exchange of views. Joss looked at his watch. It's nearly noon. Why don't we take a little break for lunch? When Ellie and Dirhir came back from lunch, Ellie noticed that Joss seemed cheerful, certainly beyond the requirements of mere cordiality. He smiled at her. I was struck by one or two things you said this morning. You called yourself a Christian. May I ask in what sense you are a Christian? I'm a Christian in the sense that I find Jesus Christ to be an admirable historical figure. I think the Sermon on the Mount is one of the greatest ethical statements and one of the best speeches in history. I think that love your enemy might even be the long-shot solution to the problem of nuclear war. I wish he were alive today. I think Jesus was a great man, a brave man, a man with insight into unpopular truths, but I don't think he was God. You don't want to believe in God. Now, if you have serious doubts about whether there is a God, you must be able to imagine a world without God. But if you can imagine that world, why occupy some middle ground? Isn't it much simpler to say there's no God? You're not being true to Occam's razor. How can a thoroughgoing, conscientious scientist be an agnostic if you can even imagine a world without God? Wouldn't you just have to be an atheist? I thought you were going to argue that God is the simpler hypothesis, but this is a much better point. If it were only a matter of scientific discussion, I'd agree with you, Reverend Joss. Science is essentially concerned with examining and correcting hypotheses. If the laws of nature explain all the available facts without supernatural intervention or even do only as well as the God hypothesis, then for the time being, I'd call myself an atheist. Then, if a single piece of evidence was discovered that doesn't fit, I'd back off from atheism. And the reason I don't call myself an atheist is because this isn't mainly a scientific issue. It's a religious issue and a political issue. The tentative nature of scientific hypothesis doesn't extend into these fields. You don't talk about God as a hypothesis. You think you've cornered the truth, so I point out that you may have missed a thing or two. You know, but if you ask, I am happy to tell you I can't be sure I'm right. Joss said, I've always thought an agnostic is an atheist without the courage of his convictions. Ellie smiled. You could just as well say that an agnostic is a deeply religious person with at least a rudimentary knowledge of human fallibility. Now, when I say I'm an agnostic, I only mean that the evidence isn't in. She paused. Why don't we just withhold judgment for a while until we make some more progress in decrypting the message? Look, we all have a thirst for wonder. It's a deeply human quality. Science and religion are both bound up with it. What I'm saying is you don't have to make stories up. You don't have to exaggerate. There is wonder and awe enough in the real world. Nature is a lot better at inventing wonders than we are. Ellie and Vege had spent the morning in a last-minute comparison of notes and interpretations of the new data. The continuing message transmission had reached an important new stage. Diagrams were being transmitted. Each picture was an array raster. The number of tiny black and white dots that made up the picture was the product of two prime numbers. There was a large set of such diagrams, one following the other, not interleaved with the text. Following transmission of the long sequence of diagrams, the unintelligible text continued. From at least some of the diagrams, it seemed obvious that Vege and Arkhangelsky had been right. The message was, in part at least, the instructions, the blueprints, for building a machine. At the plenary session of the World Message Consortium to be held tomorrow at the Elysee Palace, she and Vege would present for the first time some of the details. At lunch, Ellie noticed that Vege seemed morose. "What's worrying you, Vege?" He took a long time before answering. "Perhaps not worries, maybe only concerns. What if the message really is the design drawings of a machine? Do we build the machine? Who builds it? Everybody together? The consortium? The United Nations? A few nations in competition? If it's enormously expensive, who pays? Why should they want to? What if it doesn't work? Could building the machine injure some nations economically? Could it injure them in some other way?" Without interrupting this torrent of questions, he emptied the last of the wine into their glasses. "Even if the message cycles back, and even if we completely decrypt it, how good could the translation be? Maybe it's not possible to translate the message perfectly. Then we wouldn't build the machine perfectly. Also, are we really confident we have all the data? Maybe there's essential information at some other frequency that we haven't discovered yet. You know, Ellie, I thought people would be very cautious about building this machine, but there may be some coming tomorrow who will urge immediate construction, as soon as we receive the primer and decrypt the message, assuming that we do. What is the American delegation going to propose?" "I don't know." But she remembered that soon after the diagrammatic material was received, Dirhir had begun asking whether it was likely that the machine was within reach of the Earth's economy and technology. She recalled again how preoccupied, even jittery, Ken had seemed in the past few weeks. "Vege, do you think Ken and Mike Kitz are jumping the gun? I'm concerned that in the next few days we will see premature discussion about building something that we have no right to build. The politicians think we know everything. In fact, we know almost nothing. Such a situation could be very dangerous." It finally dawned on her that Vege was taking a personal responsibility for figuring out the nature of the message. If it led to some catastrophe, he was worried it might be his fault. "You want me to talk to Ken?" "If you think it's appropriate. You have frequent opportunities to talk to him?" "Vege, you're not jealous, are you? I think you picked up on my feelings for Ken before I did. Ken and I have been more or less together for the last few months. Do you have some reservations?" "Oh, no, Ellie, I am not your father or a jealous lover. I wish only great happiness for you. It's just that I see so many unpleasant possibilities." But he did not further elaborate. By now, the news of the message from Vega had reached everywhere on the planet Earth. Amidst the continuing frenzy of sectarian commentary, there was also, all over the world, a sense of wonder, even awe. Something transforming, something almost miraculous was happening. There was a great and soaring perception of a new adventure for the human species, of an unprecedented opportunity, or perhaps a grave common danger. The delegates arriving at the first plenary session of the World Message Consortium were predisposed toward cordiality to an extent unparalleled in recent decades. Every nation, with even a handful of message bits, was represented, sending both scientific and political delegates. A surprising number sent military representatives as well. In a few cases, national delegations were led by foreign ministers or even heads of state. President Lasker had insisted that Verheer head the American delegation, although it included Undersecretary of State Elmo Honeycutt and Michael Kitts, among others, for the Department of Defense. A vast and elaborate map and equal area projection showed the disposition of radio telescopes over the planet, including the Russian ocean-going tracking vessels. Ellie glanced around the newly completed conference hall, adjacent to the offices and residence of the President of France. She recognized few of the political and military people, but in every delegation there seemed to be at least one familiar scientist or engineer. She also noticed the technological rather than radio-astronomical background of many of the delegates, especially the Japanese. The idea that the construction of some vast machine might be on the agenda had motivated last-minute changes in some delegations. After the welcome by the President of France and a discussion of procedure and agenda by the conference co-chairman, Ellie and Vege together summarized the data. They made what were by now standard presentations, not too technical because of the political and military people, of how radio telescopes work, the distribution of nearby stars in space, and the history of the palimpsest message. They concluded with a survey displayed on the monitors before every delegation of the diagrammatic material recently received. Ellie was careful to show how the polarization modulation was converted into a sequence of zeros and ones, and how the zeros and ones fit together to make a picture, and how in most cases they had not the vaguest notion of what the picture conveyed. Vege stressed the uncertainties even more strongly than she did. Nevertheless, it was, in his opinion, now beyond doubt that the message was a handbook for the construction of a machine. The diagrams showed intricate branching networks, lumpy, almost indecently biological forms, and a perfectly formed regular dodecahedron. Each enigmatic object had an unintelligible caption. Ellie was unprepared for the response from this, one would expect, staid audience. As they finished, there was a sustained thunder of applause. After lunch, there was a succession of other presentations on the data collection and interpretation. David Drumlin gave an extraordinarily capable discussion of a statistical analysis he had recently performed of all previous pages of the message that referred to the new numbered diagrams. He argued that the message contained not just a blueprint for building a machine, but also descriptions of the designs and the means of fabrication of components and subcomponents. In a few cases, he thought, there were descriptions of whole new industries not yet known on Earth. After the session, she complimented Drumlin on the interpretation, but asked why she had not heard of it until now. He walked away, speaking over his shoulder. "Oh, I didn't think it was important enough to bother you with. It was just a little something I did while you were out consulting religious fanatics." If Drumlin had been her thesis advisor, she would still be pursuing her PhD, she thought. He had never fully accepted her. Sighing, she wondered whether Ken had known about Drumlin's new work. But as conference co-chairman, Verheer was, as he had been for weeks, nearly inaccessible to her.